From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Peruvian economist Hernando de Soto says despite communism, right-wing dictators, and massive debt, capitalism in Latin America is alive and well in the black market. On this edition of Fresh Air, de Soto tells us about his research into the black market of Peru and why he thinks the black market holds the key to the third world's economic future. Also today, highbrow, lowbrow. Historian Lawrence Levine challenges our class-bound definitions of culture. Rock historian Ed Ward turns his attention to the Pacific Northwest and to the bands that developed the region's distinctive sound. And book critic John Leonard has a review of a new memoir by writer V.S. Naipaul about his travels through the American South. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. The expression the black market has sinister connotations, a network of illegal businesses that pay no taxes, take advantage of their customers, and compete unfairly with law-abiding businesses. But a new book by Peruvian economist Hernando de Soto says the black market is a different story in third-world countries. He offers Peru's black market as a demonstration of the creativity and drive of the disenfranchised. He says a Kafkaesque system of government regulations has kept the poor out of the legal business world, so they operate illegally, but they're frequently more efficient than their legitimate counterparts. De Soto is president of the Institute for Liberty and Democracy, which has researched the flourishing black market systems in housing, transportation, manufacturing, and sales in Lima, Peru, a city of 6 million. He reports his findings in his new book, The Other Path, The Invisible Revolution in the Third World. The introduction was written by Peruvian novelist Mario Vargas Llosa. The book is a bestseller in Peru and in several other Latin American countries. De Soto is an entrepreneur and former managing director of Peru's Central Reserve Bank. De Soto began studying the black market, or what he calls the informal market, because he didn't think existing theories adequately explained the causes of underdevelopment in Peru.
The informal sector to me was interesting because it's another way for saying the illegal sector. It's all about the people who work outside the law. Informality is a euphemism for illegality. And when we measured it and found out that over 60% of Peruvians work outside the law, we said, well, surely this is an indication or a road that can lead us to the solution of why people do not work productively. And in effect it was, because we found that the law was the culprit, that people are forced to work outside the law because the law does not allow for enterprise, does not allow for the kind of freedom and coordination that is required to produce wealth.
Well, before we get to how the law forces people to work outside of it, let me ask you why you use the euphemism of informal instead of calling it a black market or an underground market, an illegal market.
Because we do not want it to be identified with criminality, which is also outside the law. That's why we define informality as illegal means to achieve legal objectives. In other words, I do not obey regulations, statutes, and law, but with the purpose of doing what everybody else is doing, building a home, manufacturing, agriculture, selling, as opposed to, for example, drug trafficking, which is breaking the law, but with illegal objectives, that is to say, with criminal objectives. So what we want to people to understand is that when we talk about the informal sector, we're referring to an enormous part of the population which, just like your Boston Tea Party, worked outside the law but for good purposes.
Through your organization, the Institute for Liberty and Democracy, you've basically deployed a lot of college students to study both how the legal entrepreneurial system works in Peru and how the informal system, the underground system works. You had your college students try to start a legal store and a legal factory and see how much of the, you know, red tape and bureaucratic stuff they had to go through to start it. Give us an example of what was required to start a store going through the bureaucratic procedures in Lima.
Well, first of all, what we did was, instead of taking the lawyer's word of how much time it took, was to measure it, as you say, in fact, sending college students out window of the bureaucracy to fulfill the red tape requirements. And this involved going to a variety of different offices and getting different type of seals and documents filled in. The result is that in terms of the store, it was something like about 45 days of red tape, working 8 hours a day. And in terms of the industry, which really were only two sewing machines with which to actually sew shirts and clothes, it took us 289 days working 6 hours a day.
What was some of the work that you had to do for those 289 days?
The work we had to do for those 289, it basically involved visiting different government offices. First of all, the Ministry of Industry, then the Ministry of Trade, then the Ministry of Norms, then the municipality, then county offices. And in 10 opportunities, we were solicited bribes, and we tried not to pay them. But in two occasions, we had no other solution, unless we wanted to interrupt the study, than to pay the bribes. Otherwise, we couldn't have gotten ahead. Now, what's interesting, of course, is we've done the same experiment in New York to find out how much time it takes to register two sewing machines that could be called a clothing workshop in New York, and it took us 4 hours. In other words, a Peruvian businessman, and probably many Latin Americans and third worlders, to start off on a business, that is to say, making it legal, making it acceptable to society and the government in special, will work 700 times more than a U.S. entrepreneur. And that, in our eyes, said a lot of why we Latin Americans are poorer than North Americans.
It also means you already have to have a lot of money to start a business, because you have to fund yourself through the bureaucratic process.
That's right. In other words, what we're trying to say is that there are no market or free market systems in Latin America, that people can do enterprise, but it's generally those people who have the resources and the time or the knowledge or the power to do so, and not common people.
Okay, let's look at what you call the informal system, or what would also be known as the black market system. There's an enormous diversity of vendors in Peru operating without licenses. Give us a sense of the extent of that. Is there a percentage that you have, the amount of businesses or vendors that are illegal, unlicensed?
Yes, well, vendors, of course, are but the tip of the iceberg, because they're actually the minority of the informal sector, but they're, of course, the more visible one, because you catch them on the streets. They're a nuisance for other people, a convenience for some, of course, but a nuisance in general. In Lima, there's 90,000 street vendors, and they account for about 60%, for example, of the sales of food. They're a very small part of the picture. What's interesting, of course, is that they are also the biggest builders of markets in Peru. We ended up by counting the amount of markets that existed in Lima, produce markets, and there were 331. Of these 331 markets, 278 had been built by former street vendors. So street vendors don't like staying on the street. You know, streets don't allow you to accumulate inventory. It's not very hygienic. You don't really have property rights over the sidewalk. So they like to move on to markets. It's not that people generally like being in the street. It's that most of them don't have another alternative.
A lot of illegal businesses sell goods that have been smuggled illegally. Is that the case with the informal system in Peru? Where do the goods come from that are being sold?
Oh, well, many of them come from the formal sector. They're quite legal.
Uh-huh.
They're produced by manufacturers. It's simply that it's more competitive to sell them on the sidewalk. It's more convenient for a lot of people. And, of course, they do sell some of the smuggled goods, but not generally on the street. These are very specifically, in Lima at least, they're very specifically located sectors of street vendors. As a matter of fact, most of the ones that are government protected, because those that are government protected or have been established there under political aegis or as part of a political program, feel sufficiently secure that they are able to pass on smuggled goods. But it's not the generality of cases, because the police would persecute them.
Why does the state allow the illegal vendors to operate? Why do the police turn their heads?
Because there's so many of them. If you figure that 60% of more than 60% of Peruvian man hours worked, and that's probably true, as I said, for Latin America and maybe most of the third world, happened to be illegally employed, the police would be spending all their time persecuting 60% of the population. That's just too many people to persecute. No government would be able to stand after a while. So they just have to turn their heads. You see, informality or black markets have ceased to be a marginal phenomenon. The marginals are we people who live on the legal side of the fence. That means to say that they're the majority, and they may be legal or informal in economic terms, but politically they vote. You can't go around chasing your voters.
My guest is Hernando de Soto, who's written a new book analyzing how the black market operates in Peru. And from that, he's drawn an analysis of why The economies of many third world countries have failed, and he says that the real free market system hasn't been given a chance, but the informal, the illegal markets are prospering because they don't have to deal with the bureaucracy of the state. Now, as you said, that the vendors are just the tip of the iceberg in this underground system. There's a system of housing, of transportation, of manufacturing, and of commerce. Let's look at the housing system briefly. There are whole illegal communities that you say have established a new system of property rights. Can you give us an example of what one of these communities looked like and how it was established?
Well, they look like most of the other Latin American communities. To give you an idea of what, first of all, the proportions of what we're talking about, half of Lima has been built illegally. You have a city of 6 million people, and that means that about 3 million of them live in homes that have been initiated illegally.
What does that mean?
Illegally means without anybody's rights. They're probably on government land that they've just simply taken by force in groups of 40,000, 100,000, 10,000, 1,000, 300 people have massively gone in there. They've created a sufficiently large critical mass that they have been able to establish themselves there against authorities. Pretty much the same way you did it in the days of the Far West or in California during the Gold Rush. They just took over the land and they squatted on it. Most, about half of Latin American cities have probably been built illegally. So that's how big it is. Today, as a matter of fact, of every 10 buildings being built in Peru, 7 are being built illegally. So it's not something that's passed away. It's a growing phenomenon. What these communities look like is they start off by being straw, houses being made of straw matting or cardboard or corrugated iron or old wood, just like any shanty town, and gradually they build up into cement and bricks and iron and get to 2 stories and 3 stories, and after 20 years they look pretty much like the rest of our houses, if they've had luck, and if their property rights have not been challenged too harshly.
Now, since there are so many of these large illegal communities around Peru, there's become a whole transportation system, a whole underground transportation system to link them.
That's right. We have tried to figure out how many of the people in the transport business are informal. And if you take the buses, it's about 90% of the buses are informal, are illegal. Mm-hmm. The rest are cooperatives and state-managed corporations. State management corporations are about 5% of the buses. But if you include taxis in the business, then 95% of public transport in the city of Lima is informal. So that gives you also an idea of the extent of illegality in that kind of public service.
Now, I think in many countries, whenever there's a prospering black market or illegal system, it tends to be dominated by organized crime. Mobsters move in and try to control the market that they've created. Mm-hmm. And in order to get your share in it, you have to make payoffs and you have to be beholden to the dons of the organized crime system. Mm-hmm. Is there something like that happening in the informal system that you're describing in Lima?
Well, we suppose so, because once in a while one does come up with some news in the papers that somebody has been abusing power, but we haven't actually encountered it directly. And the reason for that is that the informal sector is wide enough so that, in fact, they have their own rules. And their own rules are based on consensus. They're democratic. And since nobody in the informal sector has his own police force or army, it's very difficult to impose one's wills on some other people. And the way we figured that out is that the reason why in Western society sometimes mafias and criminals impose themselves in the black market is probably because they use government to do it. That is to say, they've bought out somebody who's got power in the private sector, which, as you know, has a monopoly on weapons, or close to a monopoly on weapons, or an oligopoly on weapons, and that's the reason why they're able to impose authority. In the case of the informal sector, there's no way that you can impose your authority. You just have to be consensual. And the reason, what we have found, on the contrary, are large democratic institutions, informal, of course, common law governments, but very little violence and nearly no mafiosi. Mm-hmm. It's a wide enough sector. And, of course, because they're also out of touch with formal power, which is what gives you the right to exploit other people.
I want to talk with you more about your analysis of the black market in Peru and its political implications. But first, we're going to take a short break. And my guest is Hernando de Soto, whose new book, The Other Path, is already a bestseller in several Latin American countries. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
My guest is Peruvian economist Hernando de Soto. His new book, The Other Path, The Invisible Revolution in the Third World, is a study of the black markets in Lima, Peru. De Soto argues that capitalism has never really been given a chance in third world countries because bureaucratic and self-serving government policies have made a true free market system impossible. But he thinks the black market shows that the poor are surviving by starting their own underground businesses. And these underground businesses are what he describes as the invisible revolution in the third world. I think one of the main points in your book is that many Westerners think that capitalism is failing in third world countries, but it's not failing, it's just that it's never really been given a chance. True capitalism, true free market systems have never really existed, yes?
Yes, this is correct. I think the mistake is actually one that must be corrected as soon as possible. There's a feeling that because you have private enterprise in Latin America and it's not working, that capitalism has failed or that market economies have failed. But in fact, you see, capitalism has had various stages. One of the first stages in history has been mercantilism. It was a time back in the 16th, 17th, and 18th centuries, even in so many countries all the way through the 19th and beginning of the 20th centuries in the West, that capitalism was reserved for those who were close to political power. As a matter of fact, the only way you could engage on large business in the old days in Britain was to obtain a charter from the king. The rest of us would have to have worked through the guilds. So capitalism wasn't democratic, and it wasn't open. It wasn't an opportunity for everybody. And that's what's actually been working in Latin America. It's an area where you've got to know how to deal with power and with regulations, and you've got to have good political contacts to actually be able to survive in business, at least if it's a large business. So what is failing now in Latin America is mercantilism. And now has come, as the informals invade the market, the opportunity to actually break that system and have real capitalism, modern capitalism, come into being.
It seems to me that in a way, you're fighting for the souls of the poor, fighting with the communists over the souls of the poor. And you're saying that that the poor and the disenfranchised in third world countries are frequently great entrepreneurs if given the chance in the black market, and that therefore they should have an investment in capitalism instead of in communism.
Well, that's it. And I think there's plenty of examples all the way around the world. The way we see it, and there's a chapter in the book that's called The Mercantilist Parallel, with reference especially to Europe, is that that's what happened in Europe. I mean, Oliver Twist coming into London was an informal coming to London. The poor laws were all about trying to keep him out of London. And it's only as the large pressure from migrations in Europe imposed upon the Western the change of their institutions and letting Oliver Twist also become an entrepreneur and not just a marginal dependent of the Swiss system, that you started getting the open societies that today flourish. In those countries which resisted opening up, like Eastern Europe, like Russia, the mercantilism took another form, which is communism. In other words, certain people had a different interpretation of what was going on. They said that this was an exploited proletariat, and the only way of actually fighting an unjust system was doing communism. The same thing has probably been happening in Asia in the course of the last 40 years. When the mass migrations occurred in China, you had societies like Hong Kong and South Koreans, which opened up and let everybody come inside the system and use their individual entrepreneurship. You had other societies, such as Vietnam, where on the contrary, authorities clamped down on the black markets. And corruption thrived, and of course the communism had ethical and superior hand. We think the same thing is happening in Latin America today. And that's why it's very important not only for us, but also for you, to realize that you have to make a distinction in private enterprise. There are two people that are for private enterprise, King George III on the one hand, and the Boston Tea Party. But the difference is that the Boston Tea Party believes that everybody should have a right to private enterprise without political interference. And what we're telling you is that the Boston Tea Party in Latin America is the black market.
You say in your book that you think that the communists patronize workers, and I'd like you to explain what you mean.
Well, what happens with the communists in Latin America is that they attend the calls of the poor. Their interpretation of what's going on, of course, is also erroneous, but at least they've got their hands on the pulse of the poor. They're trying to help them. But in fact, their analysis doesn't totally apply to what's happening in Latin America. For example, their whole interpretation of poverty in Latin America revolves around the fact that there is a large exploited proletarian class that's given undue wages. And our statistics show that, as a matter of fact, probably less than 5% of Latin Americans are proletariat, that is to say, blue-collar workers. that are unionized. The majority of Latin Americans are budding entrepreneurs. But since the communists are the only ones who pay attention to the problems of poverty, who reach out to people who are outside the law, even though their interpretation is long, they have an upper hand. What we're saying is that those people who sympathize with free markets, who sympathize with entrepreneurship and with democracy, should learn that the people that they generally consider their interlocutors, the people they dialogue with in Latin America, in many cases are the King Georges of Latin America. That your real interlocutors are the Boston Tea Parties, which I repeat are the underground economy. And that is much better class analysis than the communists have been able to provide so far. So if you actually do go out and touch the underground, which is what we're recommending Latin American Democrats to do, and if the U.S. foreign policy and in Western organizations do the same thing, you have got better class analysis and a much better chance at avoiding future Nicaraguas and Cubas and Vietnams.
Would it be correct to say that you're worried that if the government doesn't change its marketing system, and if it doesn't get rid of some of the bureaucracy, that you think that in your country there's bound to be either a communist revolution or a military coup?
Well, yes, these things are normal. I mean, it is happening throughout the Third World. As these mercantilist systems, which is a tight bureaucratic control over the economy, which generally favors those who are organized to take power or to work with power, as when these systems start weakening or crumbling, there's only two options to replace them. You either open up the system or you close it even further with a totalitarian dictatorship, which supposedly has a wider support. This is what's happened in Cuba. This is what's happened in Nicaragua. This is what some people are trying to make happen in El Salvador and now in Peru. So it's a question at this moment of not only getting rid of the bureaucracy, but actually changing the whole political system. Because, you see, there's another myth. It's not only that free markets haven't ever been given a chance in Latin America, even democracy hasn't been given a chance. You see, you have a tendency, like we do, to confuse democracy with elections. Elections, as somebody said in the United States some time ago, are the most entertaining form of government. But you also have elections in the Soviet Union. So elections are not democracy. They're only a beginning to democracy. Democracy is also about how you make rules. It's all about accountability. It's whether your courts allow you to protect yourself from the abuses of central government. It's about access to public information. It's about enfranchisement. And all of these other things that I've just mentioned now are not working in Latin America. So what you have in Latin America are electoral systems, and electoral systems aren't enough to be able to listen to people. You've got to have people participating in government, and that just doesn't work in most of Latin America.
Even though you're suggesting peaceful changes in the economic system, you still would be asking people who have power and have influence to give up some of it, or at least to share it, which isn't that frequently doesn't come naturally to
people
who have a lot of power.
No, it doesn't. But you see, that's what's interesting about the appearance of the informals on the scene. You see, back after the Second World War, what's happened is that the informals were really yesterday's peasants. Now, yesterday's peasants before the Second World War were spread out in the hinterland of Latin America. They were spread out in small little villages which had no political clout. As a matter of fact, they were the paradise of anthropologists in National Geographic magazine. They were supposed to be the other side of the Latin Americans which didn't want to integrate a Western-type economy. Well, all of these people have moved to the cities, at least in a great extent. Latin American cities have quintupled between the end of the Second World War, say 1946-47, and today. So all those ignorant peasants are today savvy city dwellers who are demanding their rights and who are unsatisfied, who have passed from resentment to violence to aggression to creating large black markets, and they're shaking up the system. So all we're doing is providing a diagnosis. We're saying that these people are now not accepting the status quo, are voting in many cases extensively to the left, are sometimes joining guerrillas and terrorists, and are a potentially volatile mass of human beings. So the pressure to actually make people change and share power is enormous. If people who believe in capitalism and believe in democracy, instead of reaching towards these people and agreeing that you have to change things radically in Latin America, on the contrary, call for the stabilization of the system, for a preservation of the status quo, you're only allowing these people to reach towards communist arguments in case they want to change it. What we're proposing is a revolutionary capitalism. What we're trying to tell the informals and all those who sympathize with them is that the only way to change things is not the Marxist-Leninist route. You also have the capitalist route and the democratic route. In other words, it's not that markets have failed and democracy have failed in Latin America. It's that they still yet have to be established, and that in itself is a revolutionary program. And that's why you have the title of book called The Other Path, as opposed to, in Peru, The Shining Path, which is the communist solution.
So what kind of path do you recommend? In other words, what kind of changes do you think could actually be made? Slow changes, evolutionary changes, as opposed to revolution?
Well, to start off with, we don't believe in slow changes. We believe in rapid, radical changes. And we don't believe they have to be evolutionary. We also believe they have to be revolutionary. Now, those changes start off, first of all, with good rulemaking procedures. In Peru, laws and rules are made out of the imagination of the people who rule. We make, at the central government level, which would be equivalent to your federal level, 27,000 rules a year. That means 111 rules per working day. And 99% of those rules are made by the executive branch without any accountability, without any possibility of a Peruvian to be able to seriously challenge those rules when they come out. In other words, we really have elections, and we elect a dictatorship every 5 years. Now, until that changes, Peruvians will not feel identified with democracy and will think that it's failing. What we're saying is that the first radical change there has to be is the rulemaking procedure. And that involves, of course, a series of other complementary changes. For example, access to public information. Any North American can get information from public sources of information. He can go to government and find out why it is that a rule has been adopted, but at least the press can, and then comment upon it or criticize it. At least he can find out what the reasoning is behind any proposed rule. Well, in my country, for example, there not only isn't any facilities for public information, but the access to it is forbidden by law. And the courts, of course, also don't allow you to sue government, except in Lima, and even government doesn't have to testify. And it's a lengthy procedure, which government will probably win because they also name the judges directly. So all the mechanisms that are really needed for people to participate in government decisions and influence government in the way that they are to be governed do not exist in Latin America. And these are the basis of a working and successful democracy. So the first changes we would have to make are those that would allow us not only to elect our governments, but also to make them accountable to us and to allow us to participate in the making of the rules. None of that has to be evolutionary. We should be able to do that overnight. There's plenty of examples in the Western world and even in the informal sector where rules are transparent as opposed to a closed society as is in Peru and most of Latin America.
Your book, The Other Path, has been a bestseller in Peru. Do you think it's having any effects on how the government operates or on how businesses are licensed?
Well, what's interesting is that it was the number one bestseller in Peru. It's actually, I think, the most sold book in the history of Peru, and it's been a number one bestseller in most Latin American countries, which was an indication to us that most Latin American countries have actually problems similar to ours. It's already beginning to have effect because many informals are getting organized under the banners of the book. And as a matter of fact, are focusing now most of their protest or their petition rights on the law rather than on vague political objectives. As a matter of fact, the last informal strikes in Peru, which involved more people than there are those organized in trades union, were called the strikes of the other path. So it's already beginning to have influence, yes.
Okay, well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us. Thank you for your time.
Well, delighted I've been here. Thank you for inviting me.
My guest has been Hernando de Soto and his new book, The Other Path, The Invisible Revolution in the Third World, is a study of the thriving black markets in Lima, Peru, and it's just been published by Harper and Row. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, I'll speak with dancer and actor Gregory Hines, who stars in the new movie, Tap. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Shakespeare and opera were part of America's popular culture in the 19th century, but now they're considered highbrow, aesthetically superior to rock and roll and movies. Coming up, cultural historian Lawrence Levine challenges the distinctions between highbrow and lowbrow. Well, no one has yet made a case for calling the rock and roll classic Louie Louie highbrow. Coming up, rock historian Ed Ward examines the region that gave us that hit and lots of other great tunes, the Pacific Northwest. And book critic John Leonard reviews V.S. Naipaul's new memoir about his travels through the American South. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
I'm Sharon Green. Both houses of Congress today rejected a 51% pay raise scheduled to take effect at midnight tonight. The lawmakers gave in to strong public outcries against the raise, as NPR's Cokie Roberts reports.
Only 48 House members and 6 senators were willing to go on record for the pay raise, which would have increased congressional salaries from almost $90,000 to $135,000 and given substantial boost to top executive branch officials and federal judges as well. The raise had the support of Presidents Reagan and Bush, who said higher salaries were needed to attract good people into government and keep them there. But public opinion ran heavily against the hikes. Members reported floods of mail coming into their offices and claimed the pressure increased when House Speaker Jim Wright polled them on where they stood on the raise itself and on whether the House should vote before the hike automatically went into effect. The Senate had already rejected the raise. Finally, the pressure got too great, and the House voted today to kill the pay boost and also seems ready to put to rest the plan to ban outside income for the Congress. I'm Cokie Roberts at the Capitol.
President Bush's first budget is essentially complete, according to the White House. The president went over the final items in a meeting this morning. Then he went to Capitol Hill this afternoon to start building support. NPR's Jim Angle has that story.
Administration officials say President Bush will propose a freeze in defense spending, adding only enough to match the rate of inflation. That is part of an effort to find funds for a range of programs he talked about during the campaign. That will free up about $2 billion from the budget submitted to Congress by President Reagan in his last days in office. The president told Republican senators this afternoon his budget will be a sound beginning. It will not be without controversy, he said, but it will also have positive ingredients.
It will make, I think, a strong beginning on some of the areas that a lot of us talked about in the past campaign, the environment and education, and certainly anti-narcotics, where some around this table have taken the national leadership.
But administration officials acknowledge that budget constraints will only permit the president to make a small start in some of the programs he envisions. I'm Jim Angle at the White House.
The U.S. ambassador to Tunisia met with a representative of the PLO today. The session followed a weekend clash between Israeli and PLO forces in southern Lebanon. Despite Israeli pressure, the U.S. has not cut off its dialogue with the PLO, NPR's Ann Garrels reports.
According to a State Department spokesman, Ambassador Robert Pelletreau told the PLO representative in Tunis, Saturday's incident was unacceptable and harmful to the U.S.-PLO dialogue. But Pelletreau stopped short of cutting off the dialogue. The United States agreed to open contacts with the PLO last December after PLO Chairman Yasser Arafat met U.S. conditions by renouncing terrorism and explicitly recognizing Israel's right to exist. Claiming the PLO fighters who were killed in southern Lebanon were in fact about to carry out an attack on Israel, Israel's foreign minister has said this incident is a clear violation of the conditions the United States established for contact with the PLO. While the State Department has criticized the PLO, spokesman Charles Redmond declined to accuse the PLO of terrorism. But a State Department official said it's unclear what impact similar actions in the future would have on the dialogue. I'm Ann Garrels in Washington.
Israel today defended its actions in the 14-month-old Palestinian uprising, saying it had achieved a delicate balance between security and human rights. The comment by a foreign ministry spokesman came as the U.S. State Department issued its annual human rights report that was highly critical of Israel's military behavior in the occupied territories. Stock prices were sharply higher today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 26 points to close at 2347.14. You're listening to National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. In 1987, Louie Louie was proposed as the official song of Washington State. Despite musical rallies for support on the steps of the state capitol in Olympia, legislators voted it down. Louie Louie had more or less been the theme song of a vibrant Northwest music scene that's been almost forgotten by the rest of the country. Rock and roll historian Ed Ward remembers.
A few weeks ago, I was in Olympia, Washington, listening to a couple of my friends complain about the lack of decent music up there. I know that that's not entirely the case, because the Seattle area has produced a few good bands recently, from the slightly folky Walkabouts to the thinking person's metal band, Soundgarden. But I began to wonder just how many people, anywhere in the U.S., knew what a fertile scene had once happened up there. The first big Northwest band, the Wailers, had ruled during the early 60s with songs like the one we just heard and this one. Hang Up epitomizes the basics of the Northwest sound in its pre-psychedelic incarnation. Fuzz guitar, screaming vocal, barely distinguishable lyrics. Oh, and it was simple to play, something that characterized what is perhaps the best-known record from this time and place, recorded by a band from Portland, Oregon. Kingsmen took an obscure calypso song by an L.A. blues man and turned it into one of the most mysterious and notorious records of all time. But the Kingsmen and the Wailers were only the beginning. The group with the biggest staying power was the one with the best business acumen. They'd begun their career with an instrumental, Like Long Hair, and then recorded a version of Louie Louie that got them a major label deal, even though it wasn't a hit. This led to a television deal, and, using some of the money they'd made, they bought a hit record out from under a Portland group, the Wild Knights, and found themselves with their first smash.
It's just like me, say to you, help me do, help me true. And what I'd like for you to say is you'll come home to me each day. How you be my girl, that's what I want.
Today, Paul Revere and the Raiders still play oldies shows, but they also do things like sell real estate on the side. But my favorite band from this area has got to be the Sonics. These guys had it all. A perfect garage sound, a bad attitude, and a knack for writing songs that sneered as bad as anything the Stones ever did. The Witch was the Sonics' first hit, and it sold like crazy, starting in Tacoma, their hometown. They were lucky that the Wailers' leader, Kent Morrill, had started his own label, Etiquette, because he knew that his band was too raw for the major leagues. Morrill signed the Sonics, and the hits kept coming.
Wow! Well, I had a little girl, she wasn't mean to me. Told her off, now yes, indeed.
After Louie Louie, the Wailers' Dirty Robber was the song all the bands had to learn, and the Sonics quickly made it their own, along with such other classics as Have Love, Will Travel. But my favorite Sonic song is one that would never get airplay today, that would have the Parents Music Resource Center down on the record company and everything. In it, lead singer Jerry Rossley gently suggests that his listeners join him in a dose of his favorite drug.
Take
evil. It's a wonder nobody's ever resurrected that one. Less immediately lethal drugs began to appear as the 60s wore on, and it got to where you could spot a Seattle hippie by the "I Flash Daily" button on the pea jacket. The reference was to the Daily Flash, a big San Francisco favorite once they got going. Faded faster than it began, and these days, it's just starting up again. If any of today's bands turn out as well as their predecessors, my friends may not have anything to complain about anymore.
Ed Ward is co-author of Rock of Ages, The Rolling Stone History of Rock and Roll. This is Fresh Air. Many Americans think of Italian opera, Shakespearean plays, and classical music as highbrow culture. But cultural historian Lawrence Levine says these art forms only took on their elite image at the turn of the century. Levine is the author of Highbrow, Lowbrow, an historical analysis of how Americans started differentiating between high and low culture. Levine says the terms highbrow and lowbrow were brought into the language by 19th century phrenologists, who argued that people who had high brows, that is, a lot of space between their eyebrows and their hairlines, had more space for their brains, and so the argument went, high-browed people were more intelligent. The theory never caught on in modern science, but Levine found that the terms highbrow and lowbrow, when applied to culture, stuck. Levine teaches at the University of California at Berkeley and is also a former MacArthur Fellow. His new book came out of research he was doing on minstrel shows. He found that Shakespeare was frequently parodied. He concluded that Shakespeare's plays had popular followings in the 19th century. Otherwise, how would the minstrel audiences have gotten the jokes?
You know, Shakespeare was called the Bird of Avon, and he was the most popular playwright in 19th century America, attended by all classes, played on stages in which there was also a great deal of popular entertainment, gymnastics and sword swallowing and popular songs and declamations. I wondered how typical he was, so I delved into other areas of what we now call high culture, opera, fine arts, symphonic music, to see how they were depicted in 19th century America, and I found very much the same picture. Opera, for instance, which has ironically become the very epitome of effete high-class culture in the popular mind. If you look at movies like the Marx Brothers' Night at the Opera, opera was one of the most popular mediums of music throughout the 19th century. It was sung and whistled and played, and people attended it, and it was done in English, and it was also accompanied by many different forms and genres of popular entertainment, so that the 19th century presented a very different kind of cultural picture than our own century.
Well, you really conclude that a lot of the differentiations we make between highbrow and lowbrow, or between the fine arts and the popular arts, have more to do with class than with art.
Oh, I think they do. They have to do with class, and they have to do with a sense of order. When the word culture, with a capital C, was first used in the decades after the Civil War, Walt Whitman, the poet, was very disturbed. And he said, culture is not something for boardrooms and libraries. Culture is something for people. And he looked to the new middling classes, those with bank accounts and homes, to turn to the workers and create a democratic culture with the working classes that would represent America. But in fact, what I think happened is that those upper middle classes that were newly formed when America became an industrialized modern country looked, in fact, to the gentry and the elite, as did the new plutocrats, and formed their cultural notions there, so that our schools and colleges became fixated upon this notion of something higher that was removed from everyday life. Industrialization is a disorderly process, and there was a quest and a craving for order. And that sense of disorder, that is, the crowds in theaters were multi class crowds. They didn't always act the way the gentry wanted them to. They would riot. They would throw things. They would yell. They would interfere if they didn't like the way the play was going. And what happens is that order is imposed. The first thing you do is you fragment. You begin to remove certain things from the popular theater. And then you insist on a certain sense of decorum. Even among the classes, there was a sense that we could enter the theater late, leave it early, or talk when we wanted to. The Metropolitan Opera in the 1890s had to post signs in the boxes asking people not to make noise because they were disturbing the opera singers. I mean, the turn of the century was a time when order was imposed on culture everywhere.
You use the expression the sacralization of culture. In what way do you think that culture was made sacred? What do you mean by that expression?
If you think Shakespeare was a playwright, a great one, but just a playwright, then you can modify his plays. If you think he made mistakes, you can cut pieces out. You can change endings. I mean, this was done throughout the 19th century. But if you think Shakespeare was a sacred purveyor of great art, then he can't be touched. You can't interpret him. You can't do anything to him at all. In fact, you have to, because playing Shakespeare is a matter of interpretation. But to make something sacred is to remove it from the human realm. So if Mozart is sacred, as he was not in his own day, then you can never do anything to Mozart but play him the way you think he wanted to be played, whatever that means, because it's not clear how he wanted to be played. But that's what happens. The artists become so sacralized that no one is supposed to be able to touch their music.
Is there any, like, one moment in history you can isolate as an example of how the highbrow, lowbrow separation started coming into play, how people started to make a difference between, you know, the popular arts, which weren't as good, and the fine arts, which were more edifying?
Let me tell you a quick anecdote about the early 1870s, when the great Edwin Booth was playing Richard II, and a clerk named Mark Gray was sitting with the play on his lap, and he saw Booth making many changes in the play, and he pulled out a gun and tried to kill Booth. He missed him, shot at him twice. And the point was that Booth was murdering Shakespeare, and I have the right to kill Booth. The notion that this is, for me, a mark of the sacredness of Shakespeare, that he had become an actor, he had become a cultural symbol that no one could tamper with any longer.
American artists have lived in the shadow of European mm-hmm. artists, and this is mm-hmm. especially true for contemporary classical composers, yeah. for opera composers as well, mm-hmm. I think to a certain degree for dancers. How does what you found historically help explain the raising of European culture and the looking down upon yeah. American art?
Well, the American Revolution was a cultural, was a political and economic event, but it wasn't a cultural event. And culture, especially the kind of cultural bifurcation split I'm talking about in this book, where you get high and low culture, it was very Eurocentric. It worshipped Europe. Art was European. The great music was European. We didn't have a native-born conductor of a symphony orchestra in this country for a very long time, because the notion seemed to be an oxymoron. You can't have a great conductor who's native-born. You can't have a great conductor composer who's not European.
At the end of the book, you say that you read Alan Bloom's book, The Closing of the American Mind, and that his arguments about, you know, preserving culture reminded you of the warnings at the turn of the century. Explain the comparison.
Well, what's happened to American culture in our own time in the last 20 years is, as I said before, it's opening up again. We're certainly not living in an age of cultural ecumenicism yet, but the lines are less rigid. I gave some examples of a moment or two ago. I think this, for instance, in my own discipline, history, we no longer just teach the history of military and political leaders. We're now beginning to look at the history of the folk. We're interested in popular entertainment as well as high culture, and we teach that in our courses. This is threatening. It's threatening to people like Bloom. In his book, Bloom says that classical music was the only class distinction America had. The only way of separating the high class from the low class was a love of classical music. And he sees that now no longer being perpetuated in the kids, and he's very upset. To him, rock music is junk. It's music for the bad part of the human being. It's like the drug traffic. He makes direct analogies with all of these things. Anything that that says other parts of culture are worth respect and looking at and even teaching in universities and schools is a threat to the sense of cultural order he has. You see, if I can just make one remark, which I think explains a lot, if one insists on looking at culture vertically, then there's only one top, and you have to fight very hard to keep that at the top. If one can look at culture horizontally, that is, place things next to one another, not necessarily because they're of aesthetically the same worth, but because one can compare them that way, if one can, then you have a center in which things can touch and mix and can be compared. I like to look at culture horizontally. Bloom and others look at it in a strict vertical fashion, and they're fighting very hard for their place at the top of that hierarchy, and it's too bad. I think it's a very bad and silly way to look at culture.
You're a university professor. How well is this argument accepted, do you think, among academics?
Not very well. Much better than when I was a student. And there are many more courses and much more receptivity on the part of students. But I also think there isn't enough of it. I think there are still too many professors clinging to this old hierarchical notion. The products, this is going to be very unpopular with my colleagues, but it's true, and I say it a lot, the products of bad education have difficulty recognizing good education. And many of us are the products of very bad education in this sense.
I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
I enjoyed it.
Lawrence Levine's new book, Highbrow, Lowbrow, is published by Harvard University Press. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel is joining us from Washington, D.C. with a preview of All Things Considered. Hi, Robert. What's coming up?
Hi. Well, we'll be hearing the news from Capitol Hill, where the federal pay raise is now dead. The House of Representatives voted against it. Also, the word from the FBI, it's a report of on John Tower, according to one of the senators on the committee, is they found nothing to disqualify former Senator Tower from becoming the Secretary of Defense. We will also be hearing a report from Israel about the contacts, growing contacts, between Israelis and Palestinians. From this country, the story about a man who maintains a museum devoted to Sonia Henie.
Thanks, Robert. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The writer V.S. Naipaul grew up in Trinidad, but was educated and now lives in England. He's written essays for The New Yorker and over 20 novels and books about travel. In his new book, A Turn in the South, he writes about his tour through the American South. Book critic John Leonard has this review.
V.S. Naipaul can usually be counted on to feel worse about everything than most of us feel about anything. Everywhere he looks, he sees decline, betrayal, cruelty, and chaos. Many great writers are pessimists, but Naipaul's downright contemptuous, especially of what he calls the half-made societies of the Third World, on which he reports to the First World, societies no longer traditional and never to be truly modern, from Trinidad to Argentina, from Uruguay to Zaire, from Pakistan to Indonesia. In novels like A Bend in the River and Gorillas, in essay collections like Among the Believers and The Return of Eva Peron, he is telling the imperialist West that our unseemly Congress with dark continents, silent Indians, empty spaces, and jungle rot has spawned a shameful dependency, bad art, second-rate theater, and corrupt politics, a litter of centaurs and mimics. And so his turn in our own American South comes as a surprise. Hard to imagine this gloomy cosmopolitan Naipaul eating collard greens and sweet potatoes the color of boiled carrots, or looking at cypress trees, half-stripped of leaves, their bald knees rising out of muddy water like a kind of humped aquatic animal, or sitting through an asthma attack in the great damp heat of a Mississippi swamp, or drinking mint juleps and chewing tobacco and shooting the breeze around an old spittoon. Harder still to imagine this toughest of wise old heads, who seems never to have listened to gospel, jazz, soul, or blues, being moved to tears by country music, this last angry man buying into the old Confederacy's sentimentalizing siege mentality, its romance of itself, its nostalgia and its melancholy, its idea of the past as religion and the past as a wound. Impossible, really, to credit Naipaul's love of rednecks, whom he patronizes as a kind of Indian tribe of free spirits, in baseball caps, cowboy boots, and pickup trucks, quote, wandering freely over empty spaces, people with a certain past, living out a certain code, a threatened species. I wonder what the rednecks thought of Naipaul. He seems to have gone south, unencumbered by much history, ignorant of Reconstruction, satisfied that all of the important civil rights battles have already been won, missing the point entirely of W.E.B. Du Bois's crucial differences with Booker T. Washington, impatient with rallies and political demonstrations of any kind, impressed by the processing plant at the Catfish Institute and the robots at the Nissan factory, but incapable of inferring from them anything significant about the new fast-buck South, unprepared with interesting questions to ask the likes of novelist Eudora Welty or historian Shelby Foote, trusting foolishly to dumb luck among disobliging strangers at a crafts shop or a hotel restaurant for the lapidary anecdote, the dazzling insight, the propitious phrase, never managing, after so much talk, to make it to Graceland, looking everywhere for a loss of community about which to feel mournful, needing, for reasons he doesn't go into, some kind of consolation from other people's religious feelings, sort of mushy. Naipaul, who is often compared to and has always been obsessed by Joseph Conrad, has gone into the heart of darkness and whistled a tourist's tune.
John Leonard writes about television for New York Magazine, is a columnist for New York Newsday, and is media critic for CBS Sunday Morning. He reviewed A Turn in the South by V.S. Naipaul. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. In the early 1980s, violinist Nadja Salerno Sonnenberg was hailed as a prodigy. Now she's establishing herself as one of the most popular soloists in classical music. On the next Fresh Air, a talk with Nadja Salerno Sonnenberg. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new compact disc of Pops composer Leroy Anderson conducting his own works, including The Syncopated Clock and Bugler's Holiday. And film critic Stephen Schiff remembers actor and director John Cassavetes. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Naomi Person, Phyllis Myers, and Ed Doherty. Production assistants from Lisa Bruton and Deborah Beagle. Our engineer is Joyce Lieberman. Chris Burgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.